This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the most mythologized periods in American art, the New York School of the 50s and 60s, is the subject of an exhibition that uses poet Frank O'Hara as the focal point. O'Hara is celebrated for turning the prose of everyday life into lyric poetry. He was also a curator at the Museum of Modern Art. Many of his friends were abstract expressionists or figurative painters, friends like Larry Rivers, Willem de Kooning, Alfred Leslie, and Franz Klein. The exhibit brings together paintings by O'Hara's friends, including portraits of O'Hara, and paintings that incorporate O'Hara's poetry. The show originated at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles and is now at the Parrish Art Museum in Southampton, New York. My guest, Russell Ferguson, is the curator and author of the companion book. My other guest, David Lehman, is a poet who wrote about O'Hara in his book, The Last Avant-Garde, The Making of the New York School of Poets. Let's start with one of the first things you see in the exhibit, the O'Hara poem, My Heart. Here's David Lehman.
I'm not going to cry all the time, nor shall I laugh all the time. I don't prefer one strain to another. I'd have the immediacy of a bad movie, not just the sleeper, but also the big, overproduced, first-run kind. I want to be at least as alive as the vulgar. And if some aficionado of my mess says, that's not like Frank, all to the good. I don't wear brown and gray suits all the time, do I? No, I wear work shirts to the opera, often. I want my feet to be bare, I want my face to be shaven, and my heart, you can't plan on the heart, but the better part of it, my poetry, is open.
That really is a great poem. Thanks for reading it. David Lehman, I'm wondering if you think that the poets and the abstract expressionists who were friends were working through similar issues in different mediums.
Yes, they were to a certain extent. And O'Hara was really the connecting force between the poets and the painters. In a social sense, he brought them together. And in an aesthetic sense, I think the idea at the time was that you didn't subscribe to one theoretical approach and consistently adhere to that always. You know, you were willing to try anything and to reverse yourself. At the very moment when Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning and Motherwell and Reinhardt and Gottlieb and Rothko had sort of conquered the world and abstract expressionism reigned supreme, you had these other painters, the ones who were really closer friends of O'Hara and his poet buddies, who were doing something very old-fashioned, an old hat, representational figurative painting. So that was possible to do, too, and that representational painting showed the influence of abstract expressionism. It had been nourished by that example. The composer Morton Feldman said that O'Hara was like a Fred Astaire with the whole art world his Ginger Rogers, which is a really nice comparison for what O'Hara did personally with his energy, with his uptown job at the Museum of Modern Art and all of his downtown buddies, getting them all to work together.
Russell Ferguson, do you want to add anything about the connection between what the painters were doing and what the poets were doing and issues they were each addressing in their own mediums?
O'Hara wrote a wonderful poem in connection with his friend Mike Goldberg's painting Sardines, and the poem is called Why I Am Not a Painter, and he does get into, I think, in a very complex way, he wants there to be a comparison between the act of painting and the act of writing poetry, but at the same time he acknowledges that they are different endeavors and that in a way as a poet you're always locked into language, which in a way is always going to be referential in a way that a brushload of paint thrown across a canvas in a way, especially at that time, it was felt could really escape from that kind of referentiality. So there was a close personal connection and they wanted the same kind of immediacy often in the work. But I think O'Hara also recognized that there are fundamental differences, of course, too.
Well, David Lehman, why don't you read Frank O'Hara's poem, Why I Am Not a Painter?
Why I am not a painter. I am not a painter. I am a poet. Why? I think I would rather be a painter, but I am not. Well, for instance, Mike Goldberg is starting a painting. I drop in. Sit down and have a drink, he says. I drink. We drink. I look up. You have sardines in it. Yes, it needed something there. Oh. I go and the days go by, and I drop in again. The painting is going on, and I go and the days go by. I drop in. The painting is finished. Where's sardines? All that's left is just letters. It was too much, Mike says. But me? One day I am thinking of a color, orange. I write a line about orange. Pretty soon it is a whole page of words, not lines. Then another page. There should be so much more, not of orange, of words, of how terrible orange is, and life. Days go by. It is even in prose I am a real poet. My poem is finished, and I haven't mentioned orange yet. It's 12 poems. I call it Oranges. And one day, in a gallery, I see Mike's painting called Sardines.
So this poem is about, in part, I think, about how the initial idea for a work isn't finally what the work often ends up being, that, that works evolve,
exactly.
No matter what the starting point is, whether it's a painting or a poem.
Exactly, and that the end product can, in effect, erase the origin of the poem. And the poem or the painting need not be faithful to its original impulse. You know, we say in ethics that the ends sometimes do not justify the means. But in art, almost always the ends justify the means, whatever means you use to get there. One other thing about this poem is that it made the bohemian life of the artist seem so glamorous that I think it single-handedly converted dozens of younger poets in the 1960s to poetry and to the so-called New York School of Poets in particular.
Russell Ferguson, some of the paintings in your exhibition are portraits of the poet Frank O'Hara. I'm going to ask you to describe one of them. Larry Rivers did a nude of O'Hara. Describe it for us.
That painting was done in 1954. It's an over life scale, full length portrait of Frank O'Hara. He's completely naked except for a pair of leather work boots, and he has holding his hands clasped on top of his head. It's in some ways a shocking portrait. It shows Frank O'Hara in his personality as a supremely self-confident lower Manhattan bohemian who has nothing to hide, who can be upfront about everything, including his own nakedness in this portrait. But it also... In terms of what Larry Rivers is doing with it, I think you can see an artist who's looking for other ways around painting out of the triumph of abstract expressionism. He's looking at older artists. He's looking at Géricault or Delacroix. Sometimes I think he's even looking at Anthony van Dyck in the huge scale of this, in a way, quite formal painting. But at the same time, it's inescapably a painting of its moment, which is a representation, in a way, of a New York art world that was feeling supremely self-confident. There was a feeling that they could take on any artist in the world and any artist from any period, even.
I want to add, too, that you could see in this photo that O'Hara looks like a very attractive man and a very sexual one.
There's a kind of macho edge to the painting also. O'Hara was a very cocky and confident person individually, and in that way he was also representative of the group of painters and poets and composers near the center of which he stood.
My guests are curator Russell Ferguson and poet David Lehman. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about poet Frank O'Hara and the New York School of Painters with curator Russell Ferguson and poet David Lehman. Now, there's another portrait, actually a double portrait I want to ask you about, and this is Wynn Chamberlain's 1964 double portrait of a group of painters and poets, including Frank O'Hara. Would you describe this double portrait?
Yes, that double portrait is a very amusing diptych. It shows O'Hara and some of his friends on the left. They look very serious, and they're all wearing the more or less the uniform for men at that time, white shirts, ties. And in the second version of the portrait, they're in the same pose, but they're all naked. And it's quite noticeable that in the second one, they all have big grins on their faces, and they look a lot happier with their clothes off.
And the grin is like being not only happy but gay. I mean, the diptych is a kind of unmasking picture.
Unmasking,
don't you think, Russell?
Yes, well, I think three of the four people in that portrait are gay, I believe. One, to the best of my knowledge, is actually not. But I think, especially looking at it now, it's kind of inescapable to read a gay context into it.
Would you say that homosexuality was expressed in many of the paintings of that period among O'Hara's friends or in O'Hara's poems?
Homosexuality is definitely a theme in the poetry. It's quite striking how open he is in some of the poems about the what we would now call the gay lifestyle. In the paintings, I think it's a little bit less evident, though certainly in that portrait often by Larry Rivers, I think there is definitely an erotic element.
Mm-hmm. David Lehman, why don't I ask you to read one of Frank O'Hara's poems with either a gay theme or a gay subtext?
Well, certainly. He did write about gay themes long before that taboo ceased to be as strong a taboo. And he wrote love poems to various of his lovers. One poem is called Having a Coke with You. It was written in April of 1960 upon O'Hara's return to the United States from Spain, where he had gone with John Ashbery. And he wrote this love poem for a dancer he was in love with called Vincent Warren. This is how the poem ends, and it's full of paintings and references to paintings. I look at you, and I would rather look at you than all the portraits in the world, except possibly for the Polish writer occasionally. And anyway, it's in the Frick, which, thank heavens, you haven't gone to yet, so we can go together the first time. And the fact that you move so beautifully more or less takes care of futurism, just as at home I never think of the nude descending a staircase or at a rehearsal a single drawing of Leonardo or Michelangelo that used to wow me. And what good does all the research of the Impressionists do them when they never got the right person to stand near the tree when the sun sank, or for that matter, Marino Marini when he didn't pick the rider as carefully as the horse? It seems they were all cheated of some marvelous experience, which is not going to go wasted on me, which is why I'm telling you about it.
That poem is part love poem and part art criticism. I'm wondering if you think that this period in the 50s and 60s is the period where poets and painters interact more than they do in the average period and use each other's work as the subject of their own work more than is common?
Well, one difference between that period and today is that at the time, there weren't the kind of class and money distinctions and discrepancies between painters and poets as obtains today. The painters and poets and composers in New York in the post-war era, you know, lived in the same neighborhoods, and rents were cheap. There was a kind of general optimism and confidence in the air, and there was a huge amount of collaboration between poet and poet, poet and painter, poet and composer. They hung out together. It was before fame was general. It was before the avant-garde had triumphed so utterly that everyone wanted to be avant-garde. It was a time when to be avant-garde really meant something because you were taking a terrible risk. Pollock's first, you know, abstract canvases were lampooned as, you know, being something that little kids could do finger painting. And there was a huge spectacular gamble going on. And that itself generated a great deal of excitement. So I regard that period as one in which, you know, you had a real avant-garde and it meant something.
some art movements have had manifestos, and Frank O'Hara wrote a kind of mock manifesto called Personism, in which he talked, you know, a little bit about art. And David Leeman, let me ask you to read an excerpt of that.
Okay, this is from the beginning of the poem. I don't believe in God, so I don't have to make elaborately sounded structures. I hate Rachel Lindsay, always have. I don't even like rhythm, assonance, all that stuff. You just go on your nerve. If someone's chasing you down the street with a knife, you just run. You don't turn around and shout, "Give it up. I was a track star for Mineola Prep." another short excerpt from this. How can you really care if anybody gets it or gets what it means or if it improves them? Improves them for what? For death? Why hurry them along? Too many poets act like a middle-aged mother trying to get her kids to eat too much cooked meat and potatoes with drippings, tears. I don't give a damn whether they eat or not. Forced feeding leads to excessive thinness, effete. Nobody should experience anything they don't need to. If they don't need poetry, bully for them. I like the movies, too. And after all, only Whitman and Crane and Williams of the American poets are better than the movies. As for measure and other technical apparatus, that's just common sense. If you're going to buy a pair of pants, you want them to be tight enough so everyone will want to go to bed with you. There's nothing metaphysical about it.
That's really great.
And well, what's great about it is also that it's sort of jokey and amusing, but it's serious at the same time. And the thing about O'Hara's irony and whimsy is that it's never merely irony and whimsy. He means it, too.
Frank O'Hara died in 1966. He was struck by a Jeep on Fire Island. David Leeman, a little more about his death?
Well, it was a freak accident. He was only 40 years old. He had been drinking a good deal. It was a Saturday night. He was with friends. And there's not supposed to be any traffic on Fire Island. In fact, there are not supposed to be any cars. And he and pals were going home in a beach buggy. And the buggy broke down. And along came a Jeep driven by a kind of redneck. And hit O'Hara, and he died a day or two later in the hospital. At the funeral, Larry Rivers said that at least 60 people in New York City considered Frank O'Hara to be their best friend. And in the years since then, that number has gone up by, 10 times or 20 times.
Yeah.
It was a shocking death because we don't know what he would have done. He was, by the way, haunted by the idea that he would die young. He wrote many poems about Jackson Pollock, who died in a car crash in 1956. He wrote about James Dean, Billie Holiday, Bunny Lang. Some of his most affecting poems are elegies for artists who died young. He has tremendous empathy for them. And in some of his poems, like the poem in which he talks to the sun, a true account of talking to the sun in Fire Island, seem like premonitions of his own early death.
Russell, were you going to say something?
Yes, that's true. You can see these themes all through his poetry, but in the end, sometimes an accident is just an accident, and I think the actual moment of his death is just one of those horrible things that you wish there was a more profound narrative, satisfying narrative end there, but in fact, he was standing on the beach late at night and someone drove their Jeep into him. And it's just one of those inexplicable and incredibly frustrating and tragic things.
David, would you leave us with a poem by Frank O'Hara that, again, kind of illustrates his connection to the art world?
I'd like to read a poem of O'Hara called Radio. He wrote it in early December 1955, and it exhibits his love of music, classical music, as well as his love of painting. It ends with a painting by Willem de Kooning that O'Hara briefly owned on loan from Fairfield Porter. And here's the poem. Radio. Why do you play such dreary music on Saturday afternoon? When tired, mortally tired, I long for a little reminder of immortal energy. All week long, while I trudge fatiguingly from desk to desk in the museum, you spill your miracles of Grieg and Honegger on shut-ins, Am I not shut in too? And after a week of work, don't I deserve Prokofiev? Well, I have my beautiful de Kooning to aspire to. I think it has an orange bed in it, more than the ear can hold. One other thing about this poem is that it, in its deceptively casual and simple way, it does express the very heart of romantic ideas about poetry. That is, mortally tired and immortal energy. The poetry or art is the agency of redemptive enchantment. It converts the fatigue into immortal energy. So in a certain sense, O'Hara, with all his modern modernisms and his colloquialism, and nobody made poetry sound more like talk than O'Hara, he is still operating very much in the heart of the romantic idea of the imagination as supreme.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us about Frank O'Hara.
Thank you.
What a great pleasure to talk with both of you.
Poet David Lehman is the author of The Last Avant-Garde. Russell Ferguson is the curator of a show about Frank O'Hara and American art, which is now at the Parrish Art Museum in Southampton, New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.